This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. The Premier League is still going. Just for how much longer? Nobody knows. Should we be playing? Should we be going? We will talk about the football that did happen. Trent's strike, Mike Dean's decoy run as Liverpool come from behind to beat Newcastle and keep the pressure on Manchester City at the top. Chelsea are slipping away, a little held at home by Everton, while Arsenal are into the top four. I did not expect to say that after three games of the season. Also today, Chelsea's women are out of the Champions League. We speak about the three-year prison sentence in Qatar of Abdullah Ibais. There's some Nations League, a tribute to Sergio Aguero, crypto takes over football, your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Robin Cowan, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Yes, the difficult second album for Cowan. Can she cope with the pressure? We'll find out. Nick Ames, welcome.
Thank you, Max. Hello.
Now, Nick, your next-door neighbours have an extension done. So if at some point during the podcast you hear some loud sort of whirring noises, that isn't Philippe angry with the state of football. That is just an extension in your house. Hey, Philippe.
It's actually both. good morning, evening, Max.
Absolutely. Well, whatever time it is, whenever you choose to listen to Football Weekly,
exactly.
Good day to all of you. Steve says, is Barry okay with the COVID? Neil says, with Barry testing positive, how many podders would have to go down before you requested a postponement? We have a very deep squad and Barry is currently feeling rough, but is fine. That is the latest we have. I'm sure we'll be back soon. Before we talk about Liverpool, I wonder, Robin, does it feel weird to talk about the football? Does it feel weird like it felt like the first time that this all stopped and that it sort of feels ultimately that we all know where this is heading?
Yeah, it does. I think it doesn't feel quite the same because last time the anxiety was that we don't know what the hell this is and how long it's going to last and also we didn't have vaccines then. So I think feel slightly more, I wouldn't say relaxed, but just a little bit more, we kind of know how to deal with it. I think the Premier League dealt with it pretty well the first time around with Project Restart and all that stuff. But yeah, no, it's a huge sense of deja vu, isn't it? And I don't really know what the answer is, to be honest.
Yeah, I wonder if it changes how we watch football, Philippe, and it sort of changes how you analyse it because there are so many players missing. There are so many, it's almost harder to sort of come up with narratives that we like to come up with.
I think we're going towards that stage. Like, for example, for the Chelsea-Everton game last night, the fact that the Everton side, honestly, when you saw the team sheet, you thought, who's that? Never heard of this one. So it's a little bit strange. But I don't think we have quite reached the stage we were at. And they are at, actually, in Germany with the ghost games being played in a number of stadiums there, which is, I think, something that we're going to have to get used to and to prepare ourselves for, because if there are any games being played over the next few weeks, if not months, it's very likely that either the capacity of the stadium is going to be reduced quite drastically or that we will end up what they've been doing in Germany if the numbers stay the same, and they will stay the same.
Yeah. Nick, you went to the Arsenal game. Does it still feel very much like any other football match?
Once the game began, yes. I mean, there were quite a lot of little patches of empty seats up in the upper tier, which is mainly blocks of season ticket holders who didn't show up. And I noticed some on the footage of the Brighton game the other night, there was quite a lot of empty seats there too. So I think a few people are doing what you could say is the sensible thing and opting to decide that it's not an essential social contact to go to the football at the moment. But yeah, it felt, I mean, once the game got underway, I have to be honest, it felt like any game of football I've covered, but there was definitely a sense that a few people had decided that it wasn't for them on Wednesday night, which I think is completely understandable.
I mean, Gary says, will there be a pod next Monday? Andy says, are you prepping for shows when football stops? So not that again. Burnley Watford was called off at 5 o'clock on Twitter. They announced it. The game was scheduled to kick off at 7:30. Brentford were due to play Manchester United. Thomas Frank says the weekend's Premier League games, League Cup ties next week should be postponed. Leicester Spurs was postponed pretty late this weekend. The games at Manchester United, Southampton, Watford, West Ham, Everton are off. If you are a Burnley fan that's ever complained about a lack of coverage on Football Weekly, this could be your Monday. Jurgen Klopp said in his programme notes, look, ignore those who pretend to know, ignore lies and misinformation. I trust experts. They've dedicated their lives to it and studied it. Listen to those who know best. Conversely, David Moyes said, we talk so much about diversity. If we want diversity, people should have a choice about whether to take the injection or not. We have to respect everyone. We should also probably explain what diversity means to David Moyes. I am personally getting increasingly frustrated with people not getting the vaccine, not just footballers. You know, the I think it was like a quarter of EFL players say they're not going to get the vaccine.
Yeah, 25%, yeah.
And I know there's a huge debate in the UK about COVID passports. In Australia, we have it. I know they have it in other countries. It seems very straightforward. It doesn't seem to me that it is the impending, you know, police state. But I don't know what, you know, I don't know what you do. I wouldn't mind them saying, if you're not vaccinated, you can't play football. I wouldn't mind that.
Max, I mean, the numbers are even more appalling in football than they are in society at large, which is quite extraordinary given the health environment in which footballers are living and work, where they have experts who are there to give them all the advice they need, who are pampered in terms of their health 24/7, and the numbers are appalling. You say 25%. Only 59% of EFL players are actually double jabbed. 59%. 41% are not double jabbed. In the Premier League, the last numbers we have date from 15 October. Only 68% had been double jabbed. And you compare it with what's happening elsewhere in Europe. And I got the numbers here. In France, it's 95%. Bundesliga, 94%. La Liga, 92.8%, plus 4.3% of players with antibodies, players and staff. And Serie A is 98%.
Wow.
There is a shocking cultural chasm between England and the rest of Europe, and I should say the rest of the world, because if you take the same stat, those stats in the USA, where you would think probably there's quite a lot of reluctance in the USA because of the anti-vaxxers there. Well, actually, no. MLS, 95%. NBA, 90%. NFL, 93% in terms of vax, fully vaxxed. So there's a genuine cultural problem, which is not helped by the declarations of David Moyes, I must say.
I think this converts into a logistic problem, doesn't it? I've seen a couple of journalists saying that because non-vaccinated players have to isolate if you're deemed a close contact. And so if you've got a dressing room full of non-vaccinated players, that's almost, I don't want to say it's their fault, but it's kind of, it means more postponements, doesn't it? Because you can't field a team. So they're sort of, I don't know, there's a question of why should other teams and fans pay for this in a way? I don't feel comfortable saying you have to be vaccinated, but I agree with you, Max. Like, there should be maybe a consequence of if you don't want to. I think it does, and I just don't understand this cultural thing, as you say, Philippe. I was speaking to someone yesterday who does the commentary for a club, a Premier League club, and he said one of the players there said he'd prefer to retire than get a vaccine. And I was shocked. And for me, I'd be like, fine, go ahead. If that's really what you think, because it's... I'm with Klopp. I think it's selfish if you don't.
It's a wasted opportunity for footballers to use their position in society to set an example as well, which a lot of people would look to. And I was quite interested that yesterday to see there was a picture of Giorgio Chiellini saying that he'd done his booster, I think. And, you know, he was photographed, you know, next to a sign saying, do the booster. And you know, people will look up to that. And I think it was Matt Law from The Telegraph tweeted saying, wouldn't it make a difference if the England captain did the same? Now, I'm not going to suggest what Harry Kane particularly should or shouldn't do. But footballers are in a position where they have got the power to lead by example on things like this. And I don't see that from footballers in the Premier League.
The numbers that Philippe read out, you know, for footballers are lower than society in the UK, but probably for that age group, I was actually on text with Barney. Like, there are lots of young people who haven't had, you know, the vaccine. I mean, we shouldn't single out footballers because lots of young people aren't getting the vaccine. Lots of people aren't getting the vaccine. It's like you want to headbutt a wall. There's one way out of this. Listen to Jurgen Klopp. And as Jurgen Klopp said, it's not listen to him. It's listen to him saying, I'm listening to people who know what they're talking about. Anyway, thank you for some other questions. Jason's saying, is Ralf Rangnick and his pressing philosophy so good that Manchester United have been able to pass COVID on to Brentford and Brighton without even playing them? Ralf says, is this the longest time Tottenham have gone unbeaten during a Premier League season in recent history? No losses since October. And Tom Gillingham's game's been called off. He said, this is Gillingham's best result since they beat Cambridge 2-0 in September. Should we do one game before the end of part one? Some actual football. I think that's probably what people come to this podcast for. At Anfield, Liverpool 3, Newcastle 1. Jake said, if the net on the Kop end did not exist, which goal would have stayed hit longer and gone further back into the stands? He said Trent's or Victor Wanyama's for Spurs the other year. We absolutely hammered it. But I would add Gerrard versus Olympiacos, which to my knowledge was at the Kop end. Which of those? I think Gerrard's may still be travelling. Nick?
It was one of those where when you watch it on action replay, you think you watched it in normal speed. You know, it was just an absolutely scintillating hit and the balls are rebounding back out. I think that Gerrard shot is a good shout, but that Wanyama one always sticks in my mind, actually. So if we're going with which was the hardest of those three, I'll go with that. But someone's probably got the stat. I was trying to decide whether I preferred that goal or the Thiago goal in the Champions League the other week. I think I'm still going. Thiago's. I'm going with Thiago for the skim of it. It was just like I probably watched it about 100 times. I'm sure we all did.
Yeah, I still don't know if it touched the ground or not. I'm still not
it didn't.
Sure.
It didn't.
I mean, I got a physicist to ring into TalkSport to explain the science of how it didn't necessarily touch the ground. Yes, I like the idea of what is the hardest shot to ever hit. The goal at the Kop end. The Tin Booney says, could Mike Dean be the perfect foil for Alan San Maximum? Dean's intelligent decoy runs, making space for San Maximum's driving runs from deep. His decoy run, Robin, was incredibly fun. And I can't work out if he's done well to get out of the way or why is he running in that direction in the first place?
Well, I also think it was... The run was so intelligent, it brought a Newcastle defender away. So I think they have a legitimate claim that he was really... Because also, but previously, you know, I really do think Newcastle had a case for the Liverpool equaliser, wasn't it? When I feel like he really should have blown the whistle. And I was shocked because usually that's one of his favourite things to do is blowing his whistle, Mike Dean. Although also one of his favourite things to do is also to annoy people. But no, I mean, I enjoy watching Mike Dean. What a showman. And I'll be sad to see him go.
I mean, he was in the line of sight of the keeper, but Shelvey was playing him on side. So maybe
Shelvey. What a game. Matter. What an enigma Jonjo Shelvey is. I mean, Shelvey taketh away, scored an amazing goal and then basically set up the next one. I mean, he's incredible. I remember watching him when he was, Oxford United were playing Swansea in an FA Cup game and he could not look less interested. But then he is very talented. You know, you can see he's got a very clean strike. His passing's good. But what an enigma.
I met him at a beach bar in the Algarve, and similarly, he couldn't have looked less interested than either.
What brings him joy? We need to know.
That's a very good question. Not my company, I would suggest. Eddie Howe wasn't happy with that first goal. Chris Sutton, you know, tweeting Jota's goal shouldn't have stood. Referee should stop the game if players suffer head injuries. Clearly, there were players with head injuries. Sums up football's attitude to brain injury. Nick?
Well, how said afterwards that Dean had told him that he thought the player had hurt his, was it his back, I think? So, and that was apparently the reason given. And that being the logic, there are shades of that Smith Rowe goal for Arsenal the other week at Old Trafford, aren't there, when De Gea went down. But as it seemed, and I'm sat on my sofa, not the thick of a battle, it seemed quite clear to me that there was a head injury there from the telly, and I think Howell's got every reason to be quite aggrieved. And it's never nice hearing Eddie Howell sad because he's such a mild-mannered, nice man, and he was quite exercised after their defeat at Arsenal the other week when he thought Callum Wilson should have had a penalty at 1-0 as well. Then Arsenal would go down the other end and score. So he's had a bit of a rough ride of things early on there, and I think he had a point. I don't think that goal should have stood.
I have a lot of sympathy for Eddie Howe when it comes to Mike Dean not blowing his whistle. I have less sympathy for Eddie Howe when he complained about the fact that his player was still having headaches after the final whistle, because if that were the case, it was his responsibility to take him off straight away. And that, for me, is much more important than a goal that has been allowed or disallowed.
For Liverpool, I mean, look, they were the better team. They maybe were a bit lucky, Robin, but they played well. And Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain played really well.
Yeah, didn't he nearly volley assist, which would have been absolutely sensational. Oh,
lovely,
my word.
Wasn't it?
Yeah, that was one that would make you say a weird noise exerts from your body. And also the other one, the other near assist was the Mo Salah outside of the left foot. I mean, they are absolutely purring again. It really has shades of the title race of, was it four seasons ago with Liverpool, Man City, where it was actually ended up being slightly boring because they both just kept winning and winning and winning, and they're kind of surging away from Chelsea a little bit. They just look absolutely oozing with confidence. And the fact that players like Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain are now looking confident again, just, yeah, it's slightly frightening from everyone else's point of view.
Yeah, I'd also like to point out Thiago did what I believe is the first ever quick-fire draft excluder. Jonjo Shelvey had a free kick and he was standing in the wall, and as Shelvey ran up, he kind of, this is not one for the kids, but did you ever have those toys where they were sort of all made with string, and then if you push the bottom of them, they would like collapse? It'd be like a little donkey and you'd press the bottom of it and it would collapse. Is that just me? Just me and my artisan toys in my sad little childhood? Anyway, that was Thiago. He just collapsed as Shelvey took it. Boom, down flat. Draft excluder, up he goes again. Like I always get Weevil and Weebles the wrong way around, but whichever one that the toy is. But anyway, that was just an observation of mine. And that'll do for that game. We'll begin part two at Stamford Bridge. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Now, each year we reach out to you, our readers and listeners, ask you to help us make a difference to people who really need it. This year is obviously no exception. The climate crisis is affecting our world in severe and unexpected ways, from flooding and drought to famine. You can help people who've had their lives, homes and whole communities devastated by the climate crisis by donating to the Guardian's annual charity appeal. We're partnering with charities that are focused on grassroots initiatives and are reaching those directly affected by the climate crisis. Your donation will go straight to the people that will benefit from it most. You can donate today at theguardian.com/charity2021. Chelsea won Everton 1. So Lukaku, Werner, Hudson-Odoi all tested positive for COVID-19. Ben Chilwell has his injured anyway. Kai Havertz was not in the squad awaiting a COVID test result. So you're right, Chelsea were without a lot of players. But Philippe, Everton were without so many players. I think like everyone else, I was yelling, "You've spelt Braithwaite wrong" on that guy's shirt, even.
Can you confirm the spelling, actually? Is it with an N?
It is Branthwaite, Jared Branthwaite, came from Carlisle, had a bit of time on loan at Blackburn. I confess I had not heard of this man. And there were a couple of other Everton players. I was like, I don't know who they are. It was like Anthony Gordon was like an experienced pro for them. And look, Robin, Chelsea could on any other day have won this game, but it's a brilliant point for Everton.
Huge. I thought it was like a Benitez masterclass, really, wasn't it? 20% possession, goal from a set piece, tick, tick, you know, getting abuse from Chelsea fans and Everton fans and him
tick,
not
tick,
giving
tick,
a
tick.
Shit. Yeah, it's a perfect night for Rafa, and fair play to him. And I think you touched on it earlier, Philippe may have done, you know, the situation we're in, I saw someone saying it might dilute the product. But then you do get these stories, Jared Branthwaite, teenager, on his maybe third or fourth Premier League appearance, getting a goal, an equaliser against Chelsea. So you do get these stories, no matter what happens, really. I think it's great. I mean, but again, Chelsea, really off the boil. And I was just wondering, I don't know, Philippe, you might know more about Thomas Tuchel. I don't know, it's not like a Jose Mourinho situation, but it does seem like he does occasionally, you know, has a shelf life, doesn't he? And he riles people up and maybe just things look like they're sort of, I don't know, tailing off a little bit already.
It's a very odd one, actually, because I was looking, and I don't do that very often, I was looking at expected goals for and against for Chelsea, because they've had some really strange results of late, these 1-1 draws. And in the 3-1 all draws they had, which is against Manchester United, Burnley and Everton, well, expected goals for 3.49, 2.86, 3.22, expected goals against 0.64, 0.88, 0.71. So basically, they're creating the chances and not taking them. And they're not allowing many chances, but the few chances they allow, they don't defend very well. Which, when it happens once, you think, there, it happens, it's football. When it happens three times in the space of what, a month, a bit, just over a month, you're starting to ask yourself questions about what is actually missing. And actually, one of the things which was missing is Kai Havertz, I think, yesterday. To be honest, when he's not there, it's not quite the same Chelsea. I mean, it's not exactly a crisis, because if you look, you know, they're in the round of 16. There's a small break with Manchester City, but it's only 4 points. But maybe it's their blip. Maybe it's their blip. But otherwise, yes, it's not quite as all singing and all dancing as it was at the beginning of the season when they looked like champions in the making, really.
Doesn't help that the guy they signed to address that hasn't scored. Lukaku wasn't there last night, but he hasn't scored in the Premier League since, I think, September the 11th. And there's been reasons for that injury and being in and out of the team. But they signed someone to address it. And I think the fact that he either has been unavailable or misfiring lays bare why they signed him, basically, because the other in-house options aren't as reliable. And I mean, yesterday in that first half especially, the first big chance for Reece James maybe, didn't it? And okay, he's got a great right foot and you'd expect him to put that in from there, but maybe he's not the first person you would want in that position. And then Mason Mount, obviously, who scored later, missed a good chance. There was several others, and you just felt, yeah, if you had a Lukaku type figure out there, maybe it'd be different.
You say Pickford was very good though, wasn't he, as well?
Yes, and actually his last save was sort of Banks-esque, wasn't it?
Yeah,
it was lovely to see a good old, you know, and then he yelled at someone. And Anthony Gordon, I mentioned, I thought Gordon, he looks like he's every time I see Gordon play, he looks better at football. So if he does that, if every game he ever plays from now until the end of his career is better than the last one, he will ultimately be the best footballer of all time.
And the other thing, Max, is that towards the end of the game, I had a feeling that Everton were going to get 3 points, actually. They were playing without fear, which is the great thing when you're playing with young players like that. But when they had the ball, they really went for it. So I think, yeah, actually, it's a wonderful evening for Rafa. This point is worth more than 1 point, definitely. Even though it is only worth 1 point.
I hadn't heard of... Should I have heard of Lewis Dobbin? He was the guy who dived, didn't he? Like, absolutely brilliant theatrical dive for a yellow card. Was that Dobbin? Was there a mule called Dobbin? Am I making that up?
Something you smoke, Dobbin.
Is it? Do you want to smoke a donkey, Philippe? You be my guest.
Smoke a donkey. That sounds like an expression from the outback. Oi, mate, smoke a donkey. Oh, dear.
Dobbin the Horse was a book by Gene Hamilton Ford, FF. Tales from Sunnybrook Farm. There we are, which Dobbin was the absolute star, and now a youngster at Everton. Arsenal 2, West Ham 0. Arsenal into fourth place, one of very few teams with a positive goal difference. Are they, Nick, good?
Oh, don't do that, Max. Every couple of weeks, 1 week I'm writing the sort of Friday afternoon piece saying, yeah, they're going to break the top four. Then 2 weeks later, it's all gone wrong again. And As Philippe knows all too well, it swings wildly up and down, especially among the fan base when it comes to Arsenal. But they are a bizarre team. I think we can't keep away from the fact that this Arsenal team, partly because of their inexperience and youth is really weird. Like they can look fantastic one week, and I think against West Ham the other night, it was probably a top five Mikel Arteta performance, as in one of his best five games. I felt after the game settled down, it was quite niggly for 15-20 minutes. They were all over West Ham. The intensity, the pressing, the energy, especially in the three behind Lacazette, which is becoming a very important area for Arsenal, which they finally got the hang of, I think, was just exhilarating. And they swamped them. It looked like they had another man on the pitch. They were helped by the fact that West Ham's second string defence wasn't up to much, and Bukayo Saka had Masuaku on toast, as Jacob Steinberg told me before the game he would. It was wonderful to watch, and they should have been winning at half time. They then got a lovely goal from Martinelli, who I might come back to in a bit, and then Smith Rowe cut in a great finish. And you look at the way they've set about a lot of teams at home, not all, but a lot. Villa and Spurs are two more, and you think, yeah, this is a convincing team that plays at, they're capable of playing now at a tempo that can make other teams look worse than they are. I think they're capable of overrunning teams. Maybe not thrashing teams, but of really penning them back and having these sustained spells of pressure where you think, okay, a goal is coming now, which is what definitely happened on Wednesday. I haven't answered your question at all as to whether they're good. So,
that's fine. That's fine. It was an interesting soliloquy.
I'm going to put the brakes on myself, but I definitely think they are a lot better.
I think the most remarkable transformation, it's not necessarily in the team, because the team remains, as a very young team often is, extremely inconsistent, even though the moments of goodness are becoming more frequent, as is shown by the position in the table, especially given that they lost the first three games when the team was basically like missing seven players, which we should not forget about. What has changed is the relationship with the people at the Emirates. And it's something that I've been to almost all games. I wasn't at the one against West Ham at the Emirates. The atmosphere in the ground is absolutely wonderful. I know it will surprise people to hear that about the so-called library, but the atmosphere has been wonderful since the first day of the season. And there is a proper connection between the fans and the team. And I think if you're a fan, that's what you want more than anything. You can understand losing a match, you can understand not doing particularly well in a competition. As long as this connection is there, you're happy to go to the stadium, you're happy to support that team. And that was not the case at Arsenal
between 2015 and 2020.
I think that the big disconnect starts in 2008, 2009 for me.
Okay, yeah.
But there is something happening between this young manager, this group of players, without their captain, whom, by the way, we haven't even mentioned, which shows that he's not such a big miss, is he? And their crowd. And that is very encouraging. And anyway, it's fun.
Can I ask Nick? I thought Lacazette was brilliant, apart from the multiple roles. He loves doing that, doesn't he? he was great. His contract's up, isn't it, in the summer? Is that right?
Yeah.
I mean, what do they do?
Very good question.
The trouble is they can't give him a really lucrative contract, because then yeah, they know what happens to centre forwards.
It does not tend to go well, does it, to offer 3-year contracts to forwards in their 30s. It's a difficult one with Lacazette, because I think whenever he's played in the last year, let's say, he's played really well. I think so much more sticks to him. I think they sustain attacks far better when he's playing. I think he does transmit something on the pitch. He's not really getting worse. In fact, his influence is possibly growing. But his contract is up at the end of the year. He I think was quoted at least in the French media maybe over the last international break as saying he's going to have to start looking left and right at offers in January, and I'm sure his people will be, because they have to. Mikel Arteta, we grill him just about every week, as we probably will again in about 45 minutes time, about whether Lacazette is going to get a new deal, and he just doesn't answer the question or even address it, frankly. So I don't know. Maybe it becomes more tempting if Aubameyang, as is quite possible, is not in the picture for a long time, and I think that's conceivable from the manner of the way Arteta addressed it a few days ago was I think quite extraordinary. We could go into that. If you've not got Aubameyang, then you are very light in terms of senior presence at centre forward. And personally, I would keep on Lacazette for another year or so.
David Moyes' 600th Premier League game as manager. Currently, won 236, drawn 161, lost 202. Let me read out all those results. I'll do it without my special podcast, the results of David Moyes. Only the fourth manager to reach the milestone after Wenger, Fergie and Harry Redknapp. So look, you can only applaud that longevity, can't you, Robin?
Absolutely, yeah. And the job he's done at West Ham, can only applaud that. He's done an incredible job. And yeah, I think also what was really refreshing afterwards was that everyone was talking about whether that should have been a penalty or not, which I don't think we need to get into now. But he just said, well, we should have played better. So I think he's become a bit more, apart from his diversity gaffe a little bit earlier in the week, he's become a little bit more statesmanlike, maybe more confident in his position, maybe. And yeah, just mm-hmm. been really impressed with him. I think he's got the team he wants. And, you know, I think they'll be outsiders for a top four, but great season already.
Crystal Palace 2, Southampton 2. Barry did it. He said, I don't see a point of Jordan Ayew since then. He's played brilliantly and now scored his first goal in 44 games. He's completely Iheanacho Jordan Ayew into action. Nick, you look excited.
Well, I can't think about Jordan Ayew without thinking about the number of Africa Cup of Nations games where I've sat alongside Jonathan Wilson in places like Equatorial Guinea and Gabon. And Jordan Ayew's been playing for Ghana, and Wilson's probably had a match report to write, but instead he's spent the whole game just lamenting Ayew's positional ineptitude and inability to stay on side. And he's probably the only person who I indelibly, inextricably associate with Jonathan Wilson whenever he comes up, because I've definitely heard some invective muttered his way, but he stayed very much onside and squeezed in a nice equaliser from an angle in a game that otherwise had a load of good goals, actually. The other goals in that game were really nice. But yeah, thrilled for him to have his moment.
Seems such a long way to go to watch Jordan Ayew be offside, doesn't it?
I think that was the problem, yeah.
yeah, look, James Ward-Prowse, his free kick was... I mean, he's so good at them. His 11th direct free kick in Premier League history. Only three players have got more in the competition: David Beckham, Gianfranco Zola, and Thierry Henry, which I didn't expect. Breuer's finish was great as well. We were talking about what the answer for Chelsea could be, and you know, there he is, really, you know, strong, skillful, powerful. Looks like a really fun player. And on Jack Butland plays for Crystal Palace. I did not know that. I was like, I thought when they said good save from Butler, I was like, who's Butler? Oh. There's Jack Butland. But anyway, it was quite a fun game, Robin, wasn't it? I mean, that's not really a question, but you can take it wherever you'd like, or you can tell me to ask a different one.
No, it was a fun game. And I think it just shows it's another, you know, Breuer and Gallagher, and another couple of players along with sort of Mason Mount off the Chelsea production line who are just, I don't know, they're sort of immaculate in what they do. But they also work hard. They've got the quality. I think I've just thought of a money-making scheme for Barry. You know, like Cameo, you know, you get the celebrities to do the messages. Yes. I think people could pay Barry to sort of slag off one of their players who's misfiring. They can do the Iheanacho and the Ayew. So he can have that for free. That's more what I was thinking about just then.
Yeah, any requests, please let us know. Wolves won 1-0 at Brighton. Brilliant ball from Neves. Lovely finish from Romain Saiss. Nick, any thoughts?
My thought is that I enjoy Bruno Lage calling Saiss the Moroccan Maldini, which is definitely something he had stored up for such a moment. And it was a nice finish, to be fair. And I like the man Saiss. He pops up with a goal here and there, doesn't he, as he proved. But yeah, that was my main takeaway, except the fact that Brighton... have reverted a little bit to where they were this time last year. I seem to spend most of last winter, by quirk of the schedule and where I was sent, at the back of an empty windy stand at the Amex up until about midnight every other week. And
just wishing you were in Equatorial Guinea watching Jordan or
anything, anything. And, and I think, much as I love watching Brighton and love watching and really like Graham Potter, I think I watched the same game about 8 or 9 times. And last night, I think the night before last, seemed like that again. Except maybe they didn't quite create as many chances as they have been, which could be a concern. I think Wolves could have scored a few on the break as well.
Now, Neil Maupay and Pascal Gross were left out, weren't injured, didn't have COVID. I don't know why, but they, you know, considering how many players they did have out, they must have been. They must have. I mean, I don't know if they've been naughty, but you know, for Graham Potter to leave those players out is interesting, isn't it? Tony Harrington's first game as ref in the Premier League, and his audio equipment failed. It was a sad 5 minutes for Tony, but I thought he looked exactly like a Premier League referee. You know, he was off the Identikit shelf. He's straight out of the Craig Pawson envelope, isn't he? And there he was doing his job reasonably well, I thought. The Women's Champions League, Robin. Chelsea are out. This is... I am shocked and amazed. Should I be?
Yeah, well, I was. They needed just to avoid defeat. And they lost 4-0 to Wolfsburg. It was really quite shocking to watch. But I think in the context, putting in context, Emma Hayes afterwards, so they've had a couple of COVID cases, which she announced before the game, had to travel to Germany, and she said quite a few of them were sick afterwards. And she said, not sure if it's COVID, but she also brought up the fact that a lot of them are really anxious, and I totally get that. I'm anxious, and I don't have to get on a plane to Germany and play a football game of huge importance. They're really anxious about not seeing their families over Christmas, because obviously if you test positive now, that's it. So, I mean, huge blow, though, in terms of, like, I think that's the most important thing, that most takeaway I had. But in terms of the context, the Champions League is what Chelsea are all about. That's what they were targeting, although I think everyone knows it's going to be Barcelona again. They're just completely different class. And yeah, it's been a tough week because they lost in the WSL to Reading last weekend, 4 points off Arsenal, who also got battered in the Champions League, but they're through. So tough times, but obviously the welfare of the players is at the forefront of my mind in particular.
Susie Rack is on the pod on Monday, so we'll talk more about that then. But that'll do for part two. We'll be back in a second. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Next week, we're recording our Q&A. It might be slightly more sober than previous ones. Certainly sober for one set of us, because otherwise it will be far too early in the morning for me or them. But send your questions to footballweekly@theguardian.com on anything football and beyond. Philippe is part of the panel, so we will chat then, Philippe, and it will be a delight. Let's talk about something that's happened in Qatar, Philippe. Abdullah Ibais, former media manager at the Supreme Committee of Delivery and Legacy, for which we'll call the SC, going on for the organisation responsible for the World Cup in Qatar. He spoke up in support of striking migrant workers who were starving and without their ID, including workers who were involved in stadium projects. Earlier this year, he was sentenced to 5 years in prison with no evidence against him presented in the court case. The judge denied his lawyer the right to present his defence in court. He appealed, making him free on bail. On the 15th of November, he was arrested and imprisoned just hours before an interview was going to take place with the Norwegian state broadcaster NRK. He's been on hunger strike for 3 weeks. He's lost more than 10 kilos. He's a married man with 2 young children. My mate, Avard, has been out there with Josimar. We're going to get him on a later pod to talk about it. But we've had lots of people asking us to ask you about this case, and it's only right that we do that.
Yes, I think you've summed up the case itself. The accusations against Abdullah Ibais are that he basically tried to get money for himself by negotiating some kind of... he was bribed by some Turkish guys. The accusations don't hold water. to be honest, the judicial process has been, I was going to say a farce, it hasn't been a farce, it has been an absolute tragedy, really. And what is absolutely shocking, I think, for many people around it is, because this implicates directly, it's not just about the state of Qatar and migrant workers, which is a question we've talked about and debated many times. This actually implicates the Supreme Committee, the people within and at the head of the Supreme Committee for delivery of the 2022 World Cup. That is the people who have got, I should stress that, a very special and close relationship with the FA. They've got a memorandum of understanding with the FA. And this, the appeal at which he was sentenced to 3 months in prison, lasted less than a minute. He was not present. He only learned of the verdict through his wife, who was, you can imagine, absolutely distraught. A couple of our friends were at the proceedings, Samindra Kunti, and of course Havard, whom I'm sure we'll talk at length about it, because he's also been talking a lot with Abdullahi Baiz himself. And this has, yes, it is shocking because the world of football has basically remained silent about this affair when it is something which has got to directly to do with the World Cup. This is not just a question about an autocracy and what is happening in this autocracy. It's a question about an event which is now will remain linked to what happened to one man, which is Abdullahi Baiz, who is now in jail. I think he's been hunger strike for now over a month. You can imagine the physical state he's in. He's very, very, I mean, in terms of his morale is appallingly low. But there hasn't been a word from the FA. There hasn't been, well, there's been a word for a few people within the football world, but individuals, the FA has said nothing. FIFA. FIFA have got a huge delegation at the moment in Doha because it's the Arab Cup. There was no representative of FIFA at the hearing. They are aware of what is going on, but they won't say a word because obviously it is too inconvenient. So I think that I've got to be careful here because, you know, there is, not careful, but it's very easy to go from the role of journalist to that of campaigner. And I have to say in this particular instance, I try to remain a journalist, but it's not very easy because what we're confronted with is a case of arbitrary judicial punishment of someone whose greatest crime was probably to have spoken up in favour of the workers who were striking on the World Cup stadiums. So it's very difficult to keep one's cool completely, but one has to, obviously. So let's see what FIFA can do now, because the sentence has been passed, but perhaps it is possible to put pressure on the Qatari authorities to have have him released, or at least I think what everybody's asking for, and that's also human rights organizations who've been talking about that, like Amnesty and Fair Square and HRW, is simply a fair trial, which he didn't have. And the Supreme Committee can say all they want to say, he didn't have a fair trial. And that's the point at the heart of the problem.
A question from Vicky Sparks, the commentator, saying, look, what as journalists, but more broadly for anyone who's interested, can we do to scrutinise the case ahead of the World Cup, which I know Philippe, amongst others, has been tweeting about this week? Like, what is the thing that people who care can do?
What people can do is keep the case alive, first of all, not forget what is happening to him, because in a way, the fight really starts now to get him out of jail. Put pressure on their representatives, football representatives, that is, that for people that it can be right to the FA and say, well, what's going on here? Put the question to FIFA, put the question to UEFA, put the question to all the people who have got those links in place.
Should we put the question to people who are, David Beckham, for example?
Yes, absolutely. You know, the ambassadors.
Other footballers who are ambassadors
absolutely.
For Qatar.
Who's absolutely walked away smelling of roses despite taking the money. And obviously he's not addressing this type of issue at all, but lending his name, and he's not the only one, by the way, Becker, in this case, lending his name to what is happening. And again, I insist on that. This is part of the World Cup. We're not talking about a problem which in some ways would be dissociated from the decision of awarding the World Cup to Qatar and having the tournament tournament taking place in November, December next year. This is intrinsically linked to the whole issue of the 2022 World Cup. So yes, put pressure, shame people into action. Of course, and FIFA more than anybody else. I mean, it's absolutely astonishing. They're aware of the situation. They've been warned. They've been informed. Have they said, done anything? No.
We should say, and I've got some quite lengthy statements to read out. Josimar, who, and I'd recommend you go and read their article about this. I'll tweet out again after this podcast. Josimar sent several questions to the Supreme Committee. A spokesperson for the World Cup organisers replied with the following. The allegations put forth regarding the conduct of the Supreme Committee for Delivery and Legacy's legal representatives are completely false and without merit. The SC categorically denies any allegations regarding impropriety around the ethical standards of its legal team. Furthermore, we implore Josimar to provide evidence to substantiate these claims designed only to create an illusion of impropriety before publication. The SC does not and cannot interfere or influence cases under the jurisdiction of the public prosecutor or other relevant legal authorities. Since carrying out its own internal investigation into the alleged misbehaviour, the SC has played no part in any of the legal proceedings brought against Mr. Ibais. In a statement released to The Guardian in November, the Qatar Supreme Committee for Delivery and Legacy said Abdullah Ibais's claim that he was targeted for taking a position on labour-related matter is a fabrication and a lie. The allegations presented by Ibais have no credibility. The case against him is rooted in evidence of alleged manipulation and misuse of state funds and has absolutely nothing to do with personal opinions or actions on labour-related matters. As we said, Havard Milnes from Josimar was due to come on today, actually, but we will get him on in the new year. And like you say, Philippe, the one thing we can do is keep the story alive, and we will do that. Always seems ridiculous to talk about football after talking about something as important as that, but that's what the pod's here for. The Nations League draw has been made. Robin, I must confess, I don't know when it starts and I don't know what it's for. I know it's good. I quite like it. Mm. But I'm focused on whether the Premier League's going to carry on. But whenever it's played, and I should know those things, England's group's quite fun. Germany, Italy and Hungary.
Yeah, it's good. I think Gareth Southgate's comments were true. It's a good test ahead of the Qatar World Cup. Little bit of a revenge mission against Italy. I think what I'd really like to see is Bukayo Saka pulling down Chiellini on the halfway line this time. Yeah. That's what I want to see.
Wales have got Poland, Netherlands and Belgium. Wales in Group A, so that is tricky for them. Scotland play Ukraine. That happens a lot, doesn't it? And the Republic of Ireland. Blimey, that happens a lot. And Armenia, Northern Ireland in Group C with Greece, Kosovo and Cyprus or Estonia, who may be in Group C or Group D, depending on something. Let's pay tribute to Sergio Aguero. Says he's proud of his career after accepting the, quote, very difficult reality of retiring from the sport to protect his health. When they did the first physical test on me in the clinic, the medical staff called me to tell me there was a very big possibility that I wouldn't be able to keep playing. From that point, I was processing it all, but it wasn't easy. One of the doctors told me straight up, that's enough. I want to tell everyone that I did everything possible. I dreamt about playing football since I was 5 years old and I first touched a ball. I never thought I would get to Europe, so I want to show my gratitude to everyone regardless of where I trained. I'm proud of the career I've had and I'm fortunate it is happening to me now rather than before. I don't know what awaits me in the next life, but I know there are lots of people who love me and want the best for me. The best goals per minute ratio of any Premier League centre forward, Nick, and obviously known for, you know, Aguero, drink it in. But it was just an absolutely brilliant centre forward.
My favourite Sergio Aguero game was a game that I was really lucky to cover. It was Man City v Newcastle, and I just had to check the date, but it was October 2015. And Man City were a goal down from Alexander Mitrovic just before half-time. Aguero then, between the 42nd and the 62nd minute, scored five times. And I just remember, like, I can't visually remember each and every goal, but I remember, like, a couple of them, just those glorious whipped finishes from the edge of the area, just like really thrilling stuff. And it was one of the most incredible gladiatorial centre-forward performances I've ever seen. And I'm sure we can go along the panel and people have got different or better examples. But he was just, yeah, a gladiator of a striker who just always put himself there. You couldn't ever take your eyes off him playing football. And just... he was from that sort of very insistent South American mould of striker, I think, that you also get from... you had with Batistuta, you have with Suarez, you might end up having with the guy we were talking about earlier, Martinelli at Arsenal. I had to shoehorn him in. Special to watch. A real special energy about his presence and his play, and his finishing was just something else. But that game, Man City Newcastle, those five goals in 20-odd minutes was just something I don't think I'll ever see again.
And Robin, the goal against QPR, I mean, you can, if you think about the way he takes that goal, the way he takes a touch, the way he hammers it home, it's kind of quite an appropriate goal to define him, isn't it?
Totally, yeah, because it's the composure and what was riding on that. Yeah. It's just incredible, absolutely incredible, because I think a lot of players would... It's that touch, isn't it? So Balotelli's on the floor. He has the presence of mind to take a touch and then do the trademark, absolutely smashing it. I mean, that is the moment. That it's kind of... that's the defining Premier League moment. I don't think that is going to be beaten ever. He was just a joy to watch. I think... I think Nick's right. He is the sort of typical South American player, but also everything he did was just so smooth, and the way players, sort of defenders, thought they'd had him, and then because of his low centre of gravity, he just managed to turn them just so easily, just have a little bit of space, just needed a little bit of space, and then so clinical. And I think it's not an original thought, but a lot of people have mentioned that he didn't really get a lot of sort of individual awards, especially in this country. And I think it is because we didn't really get to know him particularly. But I do remember in the All or Nothing, the Man City documentary, they did a little bit with him, and he just seemed very normal, pretty dull in a good way.
Yeah.
And I think he's a big gamer, isn't he? He's quite big on Twitch. So that might be a thing for him next, I think. So he kind of basically stayed at home from what I saw and played computer games, then went to training and did what he did. And I just think that's lovely. You know, there's no sort of falling out of nightclubs or anything like that, you know, no sort of riling up people. Just seems like a genuinely nice guy as well.
I was trying to think of, you know, moments of greatness from Sergio Aguero before we got together. And it's strange. I was thinking, in a way, I think the other perfect Aguero goal is a near post shot in the roof of the net. That's signature move. And when commentators say, oh, the keeper should have stopped that at the near post. When it's Aguero, no, it's not possible. But there's one performance I remember, because I remember coming out of it thinking, what an extraordinary player. And it was in November 2014 in Manchester, when Manchester City played Bayern Munich. And it was they had to win that game, Manchester City, to qualify for the round of 16, because they had a pretty difficult trip to Roma in the last group game. And they were 2-1 down. And yes, Bayern Munich were down to 10 men. Mehdi Benatia had been sent off. But Bayern Munich were playing better with 10 men than almost any other team you can think of. It was a tremendous German side. But Kun Aguero scored a hat-trick that day. And he scored two goals in the last 5 minutes, and they won 3-2. And you thought, this is a man for the really, really, really big occasion. So, yeah, absolutely magnificent. Bravo. And I think I might be wrong, but as well, and perhaps that's more fitting, despite the fact it's very sad, the fact that he has to put an end to his career, obviously, is that his last tournament with the Argentinian team was the one in which they won the Copa America, which is, you know, yeah, well done. Bravo.
Neil says, can you please find someone, anyone, who can explain all of this tosh about crypto bros, buying and trying to buy football clubs. Mark says, with news breaking tonight of a potential takeover of Bradford City by some strange American cryptocurrency group who are looking to use it as a proof of concept, should we be more scared than we've ever been for our future? William says, did you support Bedford before they were in the Premier League? Another William says, Max, if you sold an NFT of your face, which lower league club could you buy? We don't have time to do it on today's pod, and we want to do it justice, but we will do a special on this because it is creeping into every part of the game. And I think there are a lot of people who don't necessarily think it is a brilliant idea, and we will do. Adam says, question for Nick. Is he as excited about the arrival of Kieran McKenna at Ipswich? Let's face it, there's not been a lot to get excited about these days.
I'll keep my response brief because I've been going on for a long time about what's going on at Ipswich in the last little while. Kieran McKenna was the assistant of Solskjaer and Mourinho at Man United. Ralph Rangnick kept him on for a while. He's just been appointed as Ipswich's new manager. He's only 35, which I'm quite disgusted by because he's the first manager of my club that's younger than me. And very highly rated coach, really highly rated coach, bringing quite an elite staff with him. Very excited about that. And let's hope that in the short term, he can also get a tune out of a team that is 12th in the in League One. But yeah, it's a really exciting new direction for Ipswich. And hopefully he reaches the ceiling that he's capable of.
Let's finish with an email, which kind of links with most uncomfortable you've been listening to the pod after that chap listened to our Atleti Porto chat while having a vasectomy. And it goes back to car crashes from a few months ago. Gabriel writes, hello, Football Weekly crew. I live in Tokyo. And about 3 weeks ago, I was riding my bike home after eating tonkotsu ramen, pork bone broth ramen, for dinner. In Japan, riding with headphones or earbuds that cover or go into your ears are illegal, so instead we wear those bone-conducting headphones that keep your ear open. About 500 metres from my apartment, I was approaching a red light and noticed a car had already stopped at the intersection. Since the light wasn't going to change, I started to slow down to stop next to the car adjacent to the sidewalk. Just as I passed the rear of the car, its hazard lights turned on and the passenger door opened. I was going just fast enough to know that I wasn't going to stop in time, but still shouted, "Look out," equivalent in Japanese, hoping to scare the passenger to close the door. Unfortunately, my front tire hit the door, flung me forward, and the right side of my mouth hit the corner of the door. I was lucky, since I wasn't going very fast, I fell onto the sidewalk rather than up and over the door, where I landed in between two bushes on a dirt clump surrounded by concrete. Had I hit the door less than 2 inches higher, it would have been my right eye instead of my mouth hitting the door. I remember Max and Barry were going on about taking West Ham seriously this season before I hit the car. After I hit the ground, the first thing I heard was their voices, coincidentally still talking about West Ham. They sounded distant because I was worried about serious head damage. Thankfully, I realised it was just that the headphones managed to stay on but were significantly askew after I fell. Uncertain the condition of my body, those 4 seconds of Football Weekly were the most comforting, blissful seconds I've ever experienced. It told me I was not only alive, but still conscious after the impact. An ambulance arrived shortly after to take me to hospital, and I was discharged from the ER roughly 4 hours later, largely because we had to wait for the oral surgeon to show up as it was a holiday here in Japan. I left with cuts in my mouth, bruises on my arms and legs, some painkillers, and an unfinished episode of Football Weekly that I'm not sure I'll ever go back and listen to. While there's a dent where I collided with the door on my gums, wow, that will eventually grow back, I think, I'm happy to report I still have all my teeth. So thank you, Football Weekly, for letting me know I was alive after a potentially serious bicycle accident and turned out okay. Thank you, Gabriel. Thank you for the detail. Glad you're feeling better. Can't remember the pod. I think we may have done Should We Take West Ham Seriously a number of times. It could be one of many, but I hope you're okay. Yes, Robin?
I had an experience of the pod penetrating my brain. Okay. I have a son that doesn't sleep at all overnight, so he's still trying to do that. So I listen to podcasts. On Monday, Nader Manua, you were talking about Phil Dowd.
Yes.
And I had the strangest dream. I think, I can't really remember it, but I think me and Phil Dowd went to the cinema. that's my Football Weekly getting inside my head.
I should say thank you to the person on Twitter, it's Out of Context Football Weekly, who's worth following, who did Photoshop a picture of Phil Dowd onto the penguin. Was it the penguin? Yes, the penguin from Batman. So that has been, that is now a non-fungible token for whoever wants to buy it. Look, that'll do for today's podcast. I think we got through a lot considering there wasn't a whole lot of football. Fingers crossed all the football that is still on remains for Monday, or we will once again talk to Philippe about his life and times, because that is a fascinating subject. But in the meantime, thank you, Nick.
Thanks, Max. Happy Christmas.
Oh, and happy Christmas to you. Thanks, Robin.
Thanks so much, Max. Merry Christmas.
Pleasure. And thanks, Philippe.
And bye-bye, Max. And bye-bye, everyone.
We'll be back on Monday.
This is The Guardian.